dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day for a great victory for the cause of religious liberty. That's the cause that I'm down here hoping to add my voice to at the Faith and Freedom Coalition Road to Majority Conference. And yeah, there's a big victory for religious victory today at the Supreme Court of the United States, and it was 9-0. Why should any conservatives be unhappy with this decision? We'll talk about that, and I don't really think conservatives should be too upset about the Obamacare decision anyway. I think it was extremely unlikely, and I had said so at the time that the lawsuit was brought about Obamacare. It was extremely unlikely that you were going to have this court, which is conservative not only by ideology but by instinct. John Roberts, if there's one thing that characterizes the Chief Justice who organized this 9-0 majority, the Chief Justice doesn't like to see wrenching change that occurs because of 9 judges. It's a big country. You have 120 million people voting, for goodness sake. No more than that. It's close to 150 million people voting. And if you're going to make a significant change, then it should be through elected representatives. So we'll get to the story behind both the Obamacare decision and the decision on the Catholic Charities in Philadelphia and their ability to continue placing people in foster homes, which is some of the most important, difficult, and humane, good-hearted work going on in America. I don't know if you have any friends or family or if any of you have had experience with foster children, but it can be a very tough job, and it always is a difficult job, but it can be profoundly rewarding and a fairly amazing experience. We will also get to a question locally here. Does Governor Inslee's refusal to end the additional unemployment checks from the state of Washington, does that make it harder, if not impossible, for small businesses to attract willing labor? And that's a question for the Washington Policy Center. We'll be speaking to them coming up this hour on The Medved Show. And I'm broadcasting here today courtesy of the great help from Lou and from the whole staff here at AM 950 The Answer in Orlando, Florida. And very much appreciate the hospitality these 2 days. Okay, first up, the response to what went on at the Supreme Court today, I think, does need to be explained in terms of a variety of claims that are being made by people like Nancy Pelosi that this was actually a big win for Democrats. I want to explain to you why I think she's wrong. But the Supreme Court decision was analyzed by Pete Williams of NBC also in terms that he wanted to belittle the significance of the decision on the Catholic Social Services. Here is Pete Williams on NBC. Listen.
This is a unanimous decision, 9-0, ruling in favor of Catholic Social Services that had sued the city of Philadelphia when Philadelphia said, sorry, we're not renewing your contract to provide foster care services to find families that will adopt foster children because you won't allow them to be into the homes of same-sex parents. And the city said that violates our non-discrimination law. You're violating a city contract. Catholic Social Services sued. saying, well, that violates our religious freedom. And today, by a vote of 9-0, the Supreme Court agreed with Catholic Social Services. Now, there is a limiting principle in this decision, because what Catholic Social Services said is, you know, you need to not only rule in favor of us, but you need to strike down an earlier ruling from the Supreme Court that said there is no religious exemption to laws that generally apply to everybody. The court did not go that far. So this is the Supreme Court's way of ruling for Catholic Social Services in this case,
yeah,
but not trying to set a larger principle that said any organization is now free to violate laws against discrimination against on the basis of same-sex orientation on the basis of religious freedom.
Okay, that makes it sound more confusing than it actually is. What they were saying here was that if they carve out other exemptions that allow people to forego some of the specifics of the law, if they have another basis for exemptions, they can't discriminate against exemptions that are religious in nature. The way that this is covered in Salt Lake newspaper, Deseret News, it says that legal precedent requires the government to offer religious exemptions when it's willing to offer exemptions for other purposes and can achieve its policy goals only through other means, wrote Justice John Roberts in the majority opinion. Catholic Social Services seeks only an accommodation that will allow it to continue serving the children of Philadelphia in a manner consistent with its religious beliefs. It does not seek to impose those beliefs on others. In other words, this is not an attempt to be a sweeping decision, but it's an attempt to very clearly say there are limits to the extent that people can be bullied on this issue of their personal religious expression or be forced out of doing good work like the Catholic Social Services all agreed had done for the city of Philadelphia. The five justices joined Roberts' majority opinion, including the court's three liberals. Three justices filed concurring opinions. There was no dissenting opinion in the case. Catholic Social Services and two of its foster moms claimed Philadelphia officials violated their religious freedom by refusing to partner with agencies that, for religious reasons, wouldn't assess whether same-sex couples were suitable to adopt. The decision being 9-0, there are a number of people. Ben Shapiro had a tweet, which he had a provocative response on. He says, it seems John Roberts' main role on the court is to act as a swing vote in upholding significant left-wing priorities when possible, while brokering unanimity to limit the extent of clear originalist interpretations. There is no reason why Fulton, that's the name of this case, should have been decided narrowly here. A broad ruling, 6-3, would have been significantly better than a unanimously narrow ruling, 9-0. That was Roberts' choice. And it's very much Roberts' way, because he is trying to convey the message to people that the Supreme Court is not a political football. That basically the whole idea that there are liberals and they're conservatives and they go this way and they go that way. One of the hallmarks of Roberts' service as Chief Justice is most people don't hear about all the unanimous decisions, and there are lots of them that are made. And he particularly emphasizes that. And that has been his idea. Now, this, of course, doesn't stop Nancy Pelosi from claiming a political victory regarding Obamacare. We will get to that in just a moment. It actually, the court's decision doesn't change everything. What it does do is turn away an attempt by a number of Republican attorneys general to challenge Obamacare because the Congress had previously taken away the insurance mandate, the individual mandate. We will get to that and to much more on The Medved Show coming up.
The Michael Medved Show, all across America.
I consider myself a liberal. Your show is very entertaining.
This is The Michael Medved Show.
Michael Medved Show, the case on Obamacare that was decided on a 7-2 basis was always a long shot. The basic idea was that because the law had been changed in part, and the individual mandate when President Trump pushed through his greatest legislative triumph, which was his tax reform, Tax Reduction Act, one of the taxes they got rid of, and they were able to do by the barest of margins, was to get rid of the individual mandate, the idea that you would have to pay a penalty if you didn't get to get your own version of Obamacare. The argument by the Attorney General was that when Congress chased that piece of the legislation and changed it and basically eliminated it, it made the entire structure of the bill unconstitutional. And if the court had decided differently from the way that it did, in its third time hearing an Obamacare constitutionality case, if they had decided, nope, now it's unconstitutional because they took away the individual mandate, it would have meant upwards of close to 20 million people who would have to make other arrangements or go through changes in their insurance. And this coming right after a pandemic when people are so very conscious of medical issues and medical expenses, would have been largely a disaster. But aside from that, the originalist position here, and what's fascinating to me about this is that there were only two justices who voted actually to go ahead with the lawsuit and to strike down Obamacare. That was Samuel Alito, who, of course, was appointed by President Bush. And it's Alito and Thomas, but Clarence Thomas was on the other side. And it was Alito and Gorsuch, who was appointed by President Trump, who voted to undo the whole Obamacare structure. And the reason that Clarence Thomas didn't is because as a constitutionalist and an originalist, he is reluctant to take on that kind of responsibility and power onto the court when you are dealing with a matter of legislation and specifics regarding the legislation. That doesn't stop Chuck and Nancy from treating this as an item for great celebration. Here is Senator Schumer, clip two.
Once again today, the United States Supreme Court, in a 7-2 ruling, upheld the Affordable Care Act in the face of another legal challenge. So let me say definitively, the Affordable Care Act has won. The Supreme Court has just ruled. The ACA is here to stay. And now we're going to try to make it bigger and better. Establish once and for all affordable health care as a basic right of every American citizen.
And making it better is exactly what Republicans need to concentrate on doing. But that doesn't mean making it bigger. It doesn't mean just spending more money. It means going into a more transformative change in our medical care system that can actually increase freedom of choice, not limit it further. Nancy Pelosi also thanked the court for their ruling. This is the third time they have ruled that Obamacare has to go forward. Here's Nancy Pelosi.
So we thank the court for its wisdom in declaring the cases against the Affordable Care Act to have no standing.
Okay, and that was the basic decision by the court in this case, was simply that it was similar to the that stupid case that was brought by Ken Paxton, the Attorney General of Texas, who is in a world of trouble right now. He's being threatened with disbarment for a number of his other problems. But the Ken Paxton case was basically saying that people from Texas had a right to sue and challenge the voting returns in different states. Now, this when Congress very clearly and the Constitution very clearly had laid out that states have their own choices and get to make their own rules in terms of the way voting and voting procedures are set up. But the good thing about both of these cases is there had been a lot of continuing fear. I had also indicated I didn't think that was really a fear with any basis about President Biden moving ahead with court packing. I don't think he has any intention of doing that. The commission that he set up to examine judicial reform will probably want to create some more district judges, and all legal conservatives even acknowledge that we need more district judges. The courts are too slow. And more judges who go through the normal confirmation process are called for. But there is no indication now that court packing is going to be demanded or is going to be plausible or make any sense at all after this decision. Because with a 14-0 decision on the Fulton case, on that Philadelphia case, did I say 14-0? It would be 14-0 if they added five other justices. This is just a reminder that when people look at this, it's one of the reasons I don't like to refer to the court composition, the three liberals who are supposed to be Sotomayor and Breyer and Elena Kagan, and then the six conservatives, including the three Trump appointees. People don't come with registration cards. They sometimes vote in unpredictable ways. Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor and Stephen Breyer all wrote that decision, signed that decision with John Roberts to strike that case against the Philadelphia Catholic Charities. And there's also the idea that, that people had said, well, Sonia, Amy Coney Barrett would actually vote to gut Obamacare. There was, in October 2020, Kamala Harris, during confirmation hearings for Coney Barrett, warned SCOTUS was just one vote away from overturning the ACA. Here's what she said, clip one.
So let's lay this out for everyone who's watching. As I've discussed previously, one, Republicans have spent a decade trying to destroy the Affordable Care Act. Two, Donald Trump promised to name a Supreme Court justice and Supreme Court justices who would tear down the Affordable Care Act. Three, President Trump is before the Supreme Court right now arguing that it be struck in its entirety. Four, the Supreme Court could be just one vote away from overturning the Affordable Care Act and all of its protections, including for everyone who has a pre-existing condition or may ever get a pre-existing condition.
Okay, none of these fears of hers came true. And it's just scaremongering, and it doesn't make any sense. Meanwhile, does it make sense to continue paying unemployment endlessly, 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 supplemented unemployment, when we have a labor shortage in Washington? We'll talk about problems with the State Employment Security Department coming up on The Medved Show. Show, there are lots of governors all across the country, including Governor Ron DeSantis here in Florida, where I'm broadcasting today, and of course Governor Newsom in California, even Governor Cuomo in New York, all of whom are celebrating the end of the pandemic and everything opening up. So why is Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, refusing to end the supplemental unemployment checks precisely at a time when there are 1 million Washington State residents who had filed for unemployment benefits and other assistance due to the pandemic and related closures. Now those closures are back open, many of them, and desperate to try to get some employees. What is going on with this entire situation, and what can be done to improve it? It's a pleasure always to speak to Mark Harmsworth, who is head of the Center for Small Business at the Washington Policy Center, which gives such an invaluable resource to conservatives throughout the Northwest. Mark, what is going on with the unemployment benefits here?
Well, thanks for having me on today. Well, basically, the $300 benefit that the federal government's been adding to Washington State benefits for those that are unemployed is creating this situation where people are getting enough money to be able to stay home and go about their lives, and there's no incentive for them to go back to work. And so what we're starting to see is this situation where we've got jobs that are available and workers that are available, but the two don't want to meet because they're making just as much, in some cases, even more money, up to $3,700 at home on unemployment benefits. And it's really time, I think, for that to stop. Washington needs to stop paying out those benefits and get ourselves back to work, because right now we're suppressing our economy and we need to get this thing moving as fast as we can.
What does the governor say? Is it ultimately up to him to do this, to decide what to do with the continued benefits?
Yeah, ultimately, we're collecting $300 a week extra from the federal government. There are 25 states that have already said, hey, we're going to stop paying the extended unemployment benefits, which is partially state and partially federal money that unemployment is paid out to individuals. So those states, you're starting to see those people start going back to work. Now, in Washington, we've only just said that we're going to reinstitute the requirement to actually go look for jobs, which starts up here in a couple of weeks in July. So at this point, you can stay home and not have to qualify even for the unemployment benefits by looking for a job. But that is going to change in July, which is certainly going to help. But it's kind of late. We should be doing that now.
You've written before, and I urge people to go to Washington Policy Center. We have a big banner up at our website at michaelmedved.com, and we have links to a number of these articles. There has been a big debate about allowing people to receive unemployment benefits even if they quit. Is that still an issue that the state of Washington has to face?
Yeah, because of the Unemployment Security Department here, which is the agency that pays unemployment benefits to people, they've had some serious mismanagement over the last year. Our director, Susie Levine, was eventually promoted to the Biden administration. But during her tenure here, they had, it's an interesting promotional
prospect.
It is prospect
strange.
There.
I mean, how much did she cost taxpayers here?
We lost, the estimate is somewhere between $650 million to $1 billion. $650 million was in a Nigerian scam where a bunch of crooks got together and scammed the unemployment agency out of it. The rest of
this is like one of these things you get in your email, right?
Not quite, but yeah, that's good advice there. Don't click on the Nigerian prince link in your email. But the extra money was through other fraud. In fact, there were 50, 60 claims made against ESD employees, fraudulent claims. So their own employees couldn't even spot the fraud that was going on. So we lost a lot of money, and the systems that ESD has put in place, which they were given $44 million to fix several years ago by the legislature here, weren't sufficient enough to stop the fraud. And so you saw a lot of fraud, you saw a lot of problems. And then to reduce the backlog, because we had over 100,000 cases at one point, they relaxed the what's called the quit criteria, which allows people to quit for a lot more different reasons and still claim unemployment benefits. And that's why the numbers came down, and that's why our fund has been depleted so significantly.
The CBS is reporting that half of the states are now ending increased unemployment benefits as governments say businesses need workers. And the Montana governor, this NBC is reporting, has ending extra unemployment benefits, citing worker shortage. Wouldn't that headline actually be welcome in our state? And what's the argument for maintaining these payments?
Well, I don't think there is an argument for maintaining them. The original premise was is that people were under duress because of the lockdowns. We're still locked down in Washington state to some extent. We're, even though we're, as the federal government's told us, we're over the 70% threshold that was declared as when we could reopen the state fully, we're still locked down for another 2 weeks. But keeping these payments going is keeping the people in their homes, and it is stifling our economy, and it's time for that to stop. And it's time for us to get back out to work and start looking for jobs. So, yeah, if you stop these payments, Washington's economy is going to start picking up.
Is there any sentiment at all on the part of any Democrats who may be friendlier to small business in the legislature? Or is this simply a Washington Policy Center and conservative issue?
No, there are some Democrats in the House and in the Senate who are more moderate, and they're thinking about their constituents, who are looking at this as a nonpartisan issue, which it is, which is let's get back to work. And so they've been talking about this publicly, saying, hey, let's get this thing rolling and get the economy going again. And they were also on board with some of the votes to remove some of the emergency powers from the governor so we can make that start faster. But unfortunately, we couldn't get that through the legislature this year. So we're waiting for Governor Inslee at this point to really open the state.
Isn't part of the reluctance here in terms of giving up this level of spending that it would undermine the argument of desperately needed increased taxes, which seems to be closest to every Democratic heart?
Well, it certainly would undermine that. The unemployment fund, which started at the beginning of 2020, around $5 billion in the fund, which is that's the money that's used to pay the unemployment benefits. It's created from small business. They pay taxes on that. That fund got depleted to approximately $1 billion. And that has to be replaced either through a federal loan, which the state's reluctant to do, or as it's opted to do, is increase taxes on small business. Some are seeing 3,500% increases in their unemployment taxes to replace that money. So stopping this would negate some of the need for that money and replacing those dollars. So those taxes could come down.
Well, let us only hope so. Mark Harmsworth, always enlightening and informative. And at least you're able, though your job must have its frustrations from time to time, to look at this with a sense of humor. Find out more about Mark's work, about the work of the Washington Policy Center, which needs your support and deserves it. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the big green banner for the WPC, serving and saving the evergreen state, the Washington Policy Center. When we come back, there's another question of squandered money. The infrastructure bill hasn't been settled yet, but there's already debate about, does a high-speed rail really count as necessary infrastructure that Americans need to pour more and more money into? AOC has something to say about that, and you'll hear her sentiments and more coming up on the Medved Show.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
Appreciation again to Lou and to Pete and to all of the other personnel here at AM 950, The Answer in Orlando, Florida, which has been so helpful in helping us get this show out to you these last 2 days while I'm here for the Faith and Freedom Road to Majority convention. And it's been exciting, exhausting, and fascinating. Speaking of fascinating, there's a new Gallup poll published just now. It was taken at the end of between May 18th and the 23rd, so a while ago. But it was just recently published suggesting that most Americans support mandatory vaccines for high school and college students returning to campuses in the fall. If you go back and you look at the 3,500 people who are surveyed, 61% required immunizations, supported required immunizations for college students, and 56% for high school students. A slight majority also supported mandatory vaccinations for middle school students, with 51% in support. Now, of course, it makes sense because, yes, there are some very, very tiny risks that are additionally sensitive, apparently, for young people getting the vaccinations. But and people might also say, why now? In other words, why would the support for vaccinations being mandatory go up so dramatically, and it has, at a time when people are getting vaccinated anyway, and we seem to be turning a corner? And I think it's precisely because people do understand that getting a vaccination now is a good thing. It gives you protection. It actually reduces the incidence of the disease. And when something actually works, that is often a very persuasive factor. There's also, and I was thinking about going into some detail about this, but if you are alive and you do not have impaired vision and you can actually look around, I think you understand without a great deal of research on your part or mine. The Seattle Times had a headline on June 6th, and it said that King County had promised to end youth homelessness 3 years ago by June 2021. Well, let's see. They've got 13 days to make that. Do you think they're close to ending youth homelessness? It is pathetic, pathetic. And again, the appalling nature of this, particularly in some of America's most dynamic cities, like Seattle, and I think Seattle is one of America's most dynamic cities, like San Francisco, like Los Angeles, it's just beyond belief that people are so, in our governmental structure, so inept at actually drawing a line and recognizing that it does not show mercy, sympathy, compassion, or anything of the kind to facilitate people living in squalor and filth and dirty conditions on the street. Nor does it show any kind of compassion or concern for the businesses or for the residents or for the housed community. Can we use that term? Surrounding them. Speaking of a lack of clarity, compassion, or common sense, there's this instance. Seth Moulton and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, both Democrats in Congress, very liberal Democrats. Seth Moulton, not so much, but certainly AOC, everybody knows about. They're on with Joe Scarborough and MSNBC, talking about one of the most dubious of all the dubious elements of the Biden request for an infrastructure bill. And the request, of course, is it's been going down and they seem to be close to an agreement. It would be great if they had an agreement, but it would be great if the agreement did not include the colossal boondoggle known as high-speed light rail. And here is Seth Moulton, Democrat of Massachusetts, and he gives his own explanation of why the high-speed light rail, which has not been a spectacular success in Seattle, certainly not in terms of reducing traffic, why it didn't get included in the infrastructure bill.
I mean, you ask why we don't have high-speed rail. It's the airline lobby, the oil lobby, the car lobby. Any state in the country that wants to invest in a new highway gets an 80 or 90% match. The new airport, new runway, 80% match from the federal government. High-speed rail, nothing. That's policy from Congress. And where do you think that came from? It's big money.
Okay, it came from taxpayers who are not clamoring to ride on trains. And the whole idea of this incredibly expensive, it's now, I think it's $140 billion. The train they're trying to build from San Francisco to L.A. and never will. Here is AOC also talking with Seth Moulton and advocating for high-speed rail as part of the infrastructure package. Listen.
And we want to ask for and make sure that we fund high-speed rail equitably on a one-to-one basis with car infrastructure in the infrastructure package.
Because right now in America, we give billions of dollars in subsidies to people who drive and people who fly, but high-speed rail just isn't even an option. If states want to invest, they're not getting any support from the federal government. We just want a level playing field.
Construction of highways, it can have a disproportionate impact on communities of color from displacement and pollution. And high-speed rail actually connects these communities to greater economic and housing opportunity.
That's what it's all about, access to jobs, access to housing. That's the future with high-speed rail. And by the way, it can be carbon-free, too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the carbon-free thing is highly dubious. And if you actually look at where high-speed rail has been tried, that is highly dubious. The idea that it's going to serve communities of color. Communities of color, well, there is some representation in a new comedy. It's a new comedy about growing old and going into a senior living facility, very high-end senior living facility, when you're Ellen Burstyn and Anne Margaret and basically Jane Curtin and others. The movie, Queen Bees. Listen.
Now it's time for MedVed's Entertainment Minute.
The marvelous Ellen Burstyn plays an aging widow who reluctantly agrees to relocate to a senior living facility, but finds that its social scene is dominated by a group of tough customers known as Queen Bees, now playing in theaters and available for rent on various streaming services.
Saving seats.
Clicks.
They're like Mean Girls, but with medical alert bracelets.
Well, the reference to Queen Bees isn't to the buzz variety, it's to the B-word variety. Nicely played by Anne Margaret, Jane Curtin, and Loretta Devine. James Caan and Christopher Lloyd provide some romantic interest for the Bees, and there are some moments of sympathy and tenderness. But for the most part, the humor feels forced and the plot contrived. It's rated PG-13 for an abundance of off-color references with these sex-obsessed characters. Yeah, really. Still, the gifted 80-something cast is a saving grace. 2.5 stars for Queen Bees. And coming up on the MedVed show, well, who knows? Coming up, we will all be celebrating together, I suspect, the very first ever Juneteenth National Independence Day, as it's known, though the debate over the words will go on. One of the things that I hope will happen on Juneteenth is that it won't be focused on this individual story of how Juneteenth got to be chosen because of that corner of Texas and the experience of slavery in that corner of Texas, that we will have a little bit more substantial view of what is it that actually was able to accomplish the miraculous work of eliminating slavery. We'll also talk about a new analysis by 538 that says, yes, American democracy is threatened. It's not threatened by Republicans. It's not threatened by Democrats. It's threatened by the two-party system. How? We will get to that, and we will get to much more. Though, keep in mind, with summer coming on, things are looking up, I do believe, for this greatest nation on God's green earth.